Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome into RNIB Tech Talk, first heard here on RNIB Connect Radio each Tuesday lunchtime at 1 p.m. You can also catch us on a Thursday at 9 p.m. or Saturday tea time at 5 p.m. If you prefer a podcast, you can grab that each Friday from your podcast provider of choice, or just ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of the RNIB Tech Talk podcast. Tech Talk, of course, it's our opportunity as blind and partially sighted people to come together to explore the world of technology. We're always keen to hear from you. You can drop us a line. It's the usual email address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk, T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K, at rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, I'll be speaking with Dr. Sherry Wells-Jensen, who is a blind scientist who almost went to space. And we'll be hearing from Hubert Pavalkovich, who'll be demonstrating some of the accessibility features of Samsung TVs. So stick around, it's another Tech Talk. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Hubert Pavalkovich and Callum Stoneman. Gentlemen, how are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. How are you?
Yeah, good, good, good. Right, let's check in. What's on your technology radar this week? Callum, let's come to you first.
Well, first off, I'm intrigued about space, so I'm looking forward to hearing this.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. She's an incredible lady, you know.
Was it out of this world?
I see what you did.
Oh, where's the drums? Where's the sound effects?
I know. Yeah. Anything else, Callum? Or just terrible dad jokes?
No, I've couple of little things this week. I got a very pleasant surprise yesterday. I was on my way into work, and I got off the bus and fired up Voice Vista, as I've been doing lately. This is the kind of soundscape resurrection, and I've been using that to just direct me the last little bit from the bus stop into my office, and it started giving me, as well as the audio beacon, it started giving me turn by turn directions as well, which I hadn't realised had been implemented. It seems basic. It was only giving me a couple of very generic, you know, in 80 metres, turn right onto Deansgate. It wasn't giving me like a, you know, go straight for this many metres and turn left in this many metres. It just seemed to give me one or two fairly basic instructions. But I don't know whether it's kind of still got a few bugs with it or if it's just still in development. I imagine it's just still in development and this is just the first version of it, but it was doing that along with the audio beacon, so really, really cool. I mean, we all kind of thought new features weren't going to come in overnight, but on this case it seems to have done, so really, really intrigued to where this is going to go. If you're missing soundscape, do give Voice Vista a try. It's clearly coming a long way in just the couple of months that it's been available.
Or Good Maps Explore. They've now got the directional thing going on now as well. And you don't have to do anything. You literally just update the app and then the announcements of the points of interest come from the appropriate direction. So I'm enjoying that as well.
Yeah, it's all incredible stuff. Another thing that I've just spotted, and I haven't had a chance to try this out yet, but I can't wait to try this one out at work. Microsoft Teams have added spatial audio.
Oh, yeah. So this has been, I noticed this option for a little while, actually, and I switched it on and very quickly switched it off. I found it a bit weird where, it sort of tries to place people in the stereo field. It sort of pans some of the meeting participants. I noticed it on Windows. I haven't seen it on other platforms.
Yeah, I think it's, I know it's definitely not on mobiles. It's definitely only on desktop for now, but I think it's on Windows and possibly Mac. I don't think it's going to be something that I keep on the long term, but maybe on one of those particularly dull meetings.
Didn't FaceTime have that a couple of versions back? They were talking about having audio coming from different places, you know, and then if you've got multiple people on the call and then the person who's talking kind of gets panned into the, I don't know, I find that a little bit of a gimmick, to be honest
it
with
is,
you.
Yeah.
Mm. With mobility, like, it's genuinely useful. If you can hear, you know, that the coffee shop is over to the left or whatever, even though you're told it's the left, just hearing from the left as well, I think it just reinforces
just makes
that
a real
sense.
Difference.
Yeah. Hubert, what's going on with you?
With me, it's preparations for travel. I've bought some AirTags and they've been kind of testing them. They're really good. I've put one in my work backpack, which caused an amusement because my work phone keeps thinking I'm trying to stalk it because the AirTags are attached to my personal phone. So my work phone keeps giving me alerts that there's an unknown tracker in the phone, which is quite amusing. But I really like them. It's that's part of my travel preparations to good old America in a few weeks.
How do you get on with that whole multiple phones thing? Because I find it a bit of a faff, if I'm honest. And I'm not sure our provider will let us do the eSIM thing. I'd love to have both lines on one device. How are you managing with two devices?
I don't mind it. It's not a problem. I mean, I've only forgotten the work phone once. But I think having it on one phone would probably make it easy. I think it depends. If you like your separation, I think a work phone's perfect. But if you prefer to have, you know, not as many devices than having a separate, for example, eSIM in your phone to have used as a work phone and a personal phone, I think would be easier. And you can, for example, have multiple profiles set up or something like that. It would just make it a little bit easier and probably save some money as well for companies if they did that in a way.
Yeah, because I ended up putting Outlook on my own device, you know, just to do email and Teams, obviously, for work-related things. But then, you know, I could always sort of mute those apps or whatever if I don't want to receive notifications, you know, at the weekend or when I'm not in work mode. So we've got the tools there to get that separation on one device. But I suppose the temptation, isn't it, the difficulties in your head about, oh, I'll just go and check in with my work email when, you know, you're supposed to be out for a romantic dinner or something.
It's too easy done sometimes. I think it depends how good are you at separating yourself mentally from your work. If you are good, then this shouldn't be a problem. But yeah, I mean, on the other hand, having a work phone is good on one hand because then the other, you don't use your phone for two different things, therefore sometimes taking a lot of its battery. But yeah, I think it kind of it's a personal thing. If you like separation, it's perfect. If you're not so bothered, it's probably more convenient.
Yeah, I mean, and that is the thing, you mentioned battery there. That's one of the things about those apps that Callum was talking about. They do seem to. How do you get on with the battery and the Vista app, Callum?
Yeah, I mean, Voice Vista doesn't seem too bad. It doesn't seem too much of a battery drain. But so I've got a lot of GPS apps going on when I travel because I've got Voice Vista giving me the directions, and then I've got Move It, which is tracking my bus times and bus directions and stuff. So yeah, I think going into work, I probably easily use a good like 20-30% battery just on that commute, you know, just each way. Mm. Yeah, my phone is running low by the time I get home, definitely.
Well, I'm delighted to share that Ira has enabled RNIB's Grimaldi building. This is our new London home on Pentonville Road with Ira. The Ira access location is now live at the Grimaldi building. So if you're visiting RNIB in London, you can fire up the Ira app and you can receive remote professional visual interpreter services. I was trying this a few days ago. I was in the building and we've got a little heritage collection there just behind the shop. So as you go into the building, you go down the corridor, past the Products for Life store on your left-hand side, and then round to the left, we've got our heritage collection, and there was a photo album there of a visit that Helen Keller apparently made to RNIB quite a long time ago now, obviously. And also there was a letter that the then monarch had sent to servicemen after the First World War who had lost their sight. And the IRA agent was able to beautifully describe those artifacts, bringing that heritage to life. So if you are visiting RNIB in London and you are at the Grimaldi building, then you could apply the free IRA access offer and make use of IRA while you're at RNIB. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Interesting as ever. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk.
Here's a strange question for you. Ever thought about going to space as a blind person? Well, someone who's virtually done that is Dr. Sherry Wells Jensen. She is a blind scientist and researcher and spent 6 days living in a hermetically sealed habitat. She spoke to Dave Williams about this experience.
Now, as a small boy, I dreamed about going to space. I watched all the sci-fi shows and, of course, then reality kicked in and I let it go. But somebody who may not have let it go and is working really hard to make sure that space and related fields of study are as accessible as they can be is Dr. Sherry Wells Jensen. And we are joined by Sherry now. Now, Sherry, you have this grand title, NASA Library of Congress Chair in is it Astrobiology and Exploration? Have I got that right?
Astrobiology, Exploration and Scientific Innovation.
Goodness me. Well, we've got so much to talk about, not just about your role, but also your journey. So let's start at the beginning then. What can you tell us about your personal journey that has led you to working in this field?
Well, I think maybe we were the same little kid, just on opposite sides of the pond here, because I also thought, I want to do that. Look at that space thing. That's where it is. That's where there's all kinds of new stuff happening and it's very exciting. And I don't know, you just get this catch in your throat and you feel the wonder of things. And that's what I thought that's what I want to do. And, you know, in reality, not most of us are going to space, right? Only 600 people have gone so far out of what we're pushing, 8 billion folks. So not everybody's going to go, but everybody dreams about it, right? And I wanted to study astronomy and physics so I'd be well positioned to be an astronaut. And as I got older, and you know, when you're a little kid, everybody wants to be Batman, and you know, some of our dreams of professions are we're all going to be firefighters or superheroes. Or I think my eldest child told me that they were going to be the person that founded the first waffle restaurant on Mars. Like that for years was what they said. I'm like, okay, my child, let's dream about that. But I mean, the thing is that some people's dreams are allowed to just flow into adulthood and adulthood shapes them. But for some of us, people with disabilities, our dreams, when we start to flow into adulthood, we start to see artificial reasons why we cannot. There's a really good reason why most of us are not going to be an astronaut, right? Because there's just most of us are not going to be an astronaut. But for disabled people, we don't even get to try. And so I wanted to study physics and astronomy, and it just became really clear to me. I was a smart kid. I could read the room, that it was going to be kind of a pain in everybody's backside if I persisted. And, you know, it's not all about success in life is not about just grimly sticking to your idea about what you are going to do and ignoring all the human beings around you, right? A lot of us, you know, you have to make your way. And so I didn't go into astronomy and physics. It just, you know, whenever it was time to braille the next math book, I got a lot of, well, I guess we could do this. And I thought, well, you know, there's probably other good things I could do. And so I became a linguist, which is fun. And it's science just with language. And one of the things that linguists can do is we can study how to construct a message that you would send to another planet. So maybe, you know, I wasn't going into space, but maybe I could help think about messages, or I could help think about other things that have to do with human factors in space. And then I started thinking about, well, why the heck am I like that? Why not push for the things that I really want to have happen in the world? And when I first got into this field and I was thinking about, I guess I'll think about aliens and what would the aliens be like? And so I decided that I would do, what would an alien civilization be like if none of them could see? If there were no word for blindness because there was no word for sight, right? If the aliens were not seeing it, that just never entered into the picture. Could they develop science? And what would that science be like? And I very excitedly wrote this paper. And you know, human science started with medicine, astronomy, and mathematics, right? So I could see how blind people would do medicine and mathematics, but astronomy, not so much, not at first, right? And I wrote this paper about how, you know, the blind scientists, the blind aliens did their thing, and they were, you know, they I figured out how we could probably smelt metal and how we could discover electricity, which is invisible anyway, by the way, so no big deal. And I gave this paper in front of a group of scientists and we argued about it. We had so much fun. We argued back and forth, like, oh, could you do that? Yeah, okay. And by the end of the hour, I had them with me, right? They were all like, okay, we get it. Blind aliens could build a radio telescope. They could have technology. They could do all the things. We're with you. And so feeling triumphant, I turned around to walk back to my seat and there were three shallow carpeted steps that went from the stage down into those chairs where I'd been sitting before. And somebody leapt up from the front row and came zooming up onto the stage to grab my arm to help me down those three steps that I had just climbed 45 minutes before, hour before. And I thought, oh, merciful heavens. So the blind aliens can smelt metal and build a telescope, but the blind human in this room is considered incapable of walking down three stairs that I just walked up. And so I thought, mercy, we have a lot to do. We've got a long ways to go.
Yeah, we do. And I mean, Sherry, not to put too fine a point on it, you obviously as a blind person and as a woman, right, you must have faced just so many kind of institutional biases in trying to make a career in science, whether that be astronomy or linguistics.
Right. I'm a first generation college student. My parents worked hard and were great human beings, but did not go to college. Right. I think my mom finally got an associate's degree like in her 60s or something like that. So, yeah, there's just a lot of we absorb a lot of messages along the way telling us what we're supposed to do.
So what gave you the confidence to challenge that?
Oh, you know, it just sort of happened, right? And eventually, I think as you get older, you start to think, well, the heck with that. That doesn't make any sense. I'm not going to worry about that anymore. I mean, you know, we all as we get older, we do more of the things that we want to do. And in my case, as I started thinking about these blind aliens and blind people in general and disabled people in general, I realized that there was a pressing need. It wasn't just about a thing that I wanted to do. I realized that if we're going to send people to space, which is a profoundly dangerous and disabling environment, we are going to have disabled people in space. This is not a choice that we're going to make to send people or not. We can send perfectly able-bodied people into space and they will become disabled there because space is terribly dangerous. Space is always trying to kill you. And if space can't kill you, it's perfectly happy to injure you or disable you. And so if we're going to have these disabled people in space, we better prepare for it. So it felt to me like it was an urgent need that we talk about this and that we as disabled people here on Earth use our expertise to make space accessible to the disabled people who are going to be there anyway because they'll be made there. And then we can recruit disabled people. Disabled people can go into those fields if we've already made space accessible.
Before we talk about your latest adventure, which I could not believe this when I stumbled across this story online, I thought I have to connect. But when I was doing a bit of more research, because you and I talked about what we were going to talk about, and I didn't mention this because I didn't find out about it until a couple of days ago, you were also a consultant on Star Trek.
I was. Oh my god, that was the best thing. That is the best thing I've ever done.
Tell me about that.
Screaming. So I'm a member of Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence International, which is an organization, METI International, which is thinking about, should we send messages to space? Do we, you know, is it a good idea? How would we build those messages? How can we make humanity ready for it? And METI was a consultant. METI was called. We have someone from Star Trek on our board of directors. And the person said, you know, we're having a Star Trek episode where there is a communication problem. Do y'all have a linguist? I'm like, do we have a linguist? Oh my God. We have a linguist who like lived and breathed Star Trek as a child, just like on the tummy, on the living room floor, right in front of the television. Every time anything Star Trek came on, I was so in love with all of it. And so to find myself on Zoom calls with producers of Star Trek arguing about Star Trek dialogue that some, you know, that Captain Kirk was going to say or Captain Pike was going to say, like any of those guys, right, was the most amazing thing that I've ever done. Like, no, he can't say that. That doesn't make any sense. And I thought to myself, I just said that to a Star Trek producer.
Fantastic. Wow. That's incredible. Well, I love the show and glad that you got to work on it. So let's talk about those 6 days then that you spent in the University of Arizona Biosphere 2. How on earth did you get there and what was it like?
So, I mean, you can't just go to space without doing all kinds of preparation, right? And so we prepared things like we make sure we have the right tools, we make sure we have the right mission plan. And then there's just a lot of things you can't know, right? And one of the ways you prepare for the things that you can't know is you run simulations. So we were on the campus of Biosphere 2 in a smaller Biosphere 2. You can go there. That's in case folks don't know the history, it's in 1998, people. The Biospherians entered Biosphere 2, which is a sealed habitat, and they were going to see what it was like to live there. Their goal was to live there for 2 years without any input from the outside world. Just, can you make a sustainable enclosed habitat? And on the campus of Biosphere 2, there is a smaller unit that has just opened up simulated environments for the Mars and the Moon, and we arbitrarily chose the Moon. And basically, you take four people who didn't know each other very well beforehand, and you give them some basic training, ask them please to be nice to each other, and you pop them into the small environment, and you leave them there for 6 days, and you say, okay, here's the water you have, friends. Don't use any more than that. Here's the food you have, friends. You know, eat it all if you want to, but that's all you're getting. And here are some jobs for you to do. Now, what I want you to do is, you don't get to come out. You can email out, but obviously you don't get to come out. There's no voice contact. We just said email back to planet Earth. And the idea is that you run this as though you were on the Moon. You get only your things that you brought with you. And it's kind of this line between playing pretend and being really on Mars, right? Sometimes or on the Moon. Sometimes I thought, oh, we're just goofing around here. And then sometimes I thought, no, this is kind of serious. So if our carbon dioxide levels go up, we have to see if we can get them back down. We have to work together to, you know, to do the experiments that we brought in to do. And we had to get along, which, you know, they're nice people. We got along. And if we want to go outside, we have to put on a spacesuit. So that's what we did for 6 days.
And what was the selection process for that, Sherry?
So I think what you do is you have a team designer. And our team designer decided that what she wanted us to do, and we were the very first science, we're the very first of any group to live in that new habitat. And what she said she wanted to do was inclusion. So the first two missions were called Inclusion 1 and Inclusion 2. And we were selected based on, let's see if we could have one of everything, right? There were three women and one man. We had diversity, we had gender diversity, we had experience diversity. We were from a couple different countries, and we had one blind person. So we had disability diversity as well.
And what were your initial thoughts and feelings as you kind of embarked on that mission when you went in there the first 5 minutes, the first hour? What was that like?
So I got a walkthrough beforehand because I said, look, I want to know where things are. There's going to be some things I need labeled. And so let's us have a walkthrough. And they're like, okay, we're still putting a few things in place, but you can come down and you can walk through it if you want to. And I was with one of the technicians and I said, well, you know, at least let me find my coffee cup beforehand. And, you know, let me label a couple things. I'm going to put a couple labels on a couple things that might be important later. And let me get oriented to the place. And when I first stepped in, I walked into, it was the oldest module, because a historic module that was used in the 1980s, all made of metal and glass, kind of shaped like a rocket. So it was a very tall and thin room going up a couple stories, all metal, all glass with a metal floor. And when I first walked into it, it was very, very echoey. You know, that feeling, that noise, like from if you're in a tiled room and then there were a couple fans going. And so the auditory fog in my head was incredible. I thought, and the floor was metal. And you know how sometimes when you step on metal, it kind of goes bump and it bumps down and kind of bumps up. And I thought, oh, holy heck, save me from this. This is going to be terrible. I cannot live for 6 days in this environment where I cannot hear anything. You know, there are deafblind skills, but I don't have them. And I thought, I'm going to be miserable. I don't like it. And then, and so we went around that room and I thought, okay, just breathe, be calm. Don't be a child. You can manage this. And then we went to go into the next module, which is connected in an interesting way. You have to sort of climb up a little ladder and scoot through what used to be a window into the next room in the habitat. And the next room in the habitat, which was the engineering bay, was perfectly fine. Big, giant breath of relief. The acoustics were quite manageable. I could hear where things were. And so my first moments of somebody send a helicopter and get me out of here faded to, okay, I can do this. These are reasonably nice people that I'm with. We all seem to get along pretty well. Everybody's feeling kind of enthusiastic, so I will just join the ranks of people who are enthusiastic about this. And I just won't go into that first room very often unless I really have to.
We will return to Dave's conversation with Dr. Sherry Wells Jensen a little bit later.
Previously here on Tech Talk, we had a chat about Apple TV and how accessible that is and how it could help to make your TV into a smart TV if it isn't already, or how it can make the smart TV world more accessible for you as a blind and partially sighted user. Recently on Tech Talk, though, we have been talking about Samsung TVs. And during my Apple TV demonstration, I have also mentioned how accessible they are. Well, today, this is what we are going to show you. We will show you a bit of how accessible the Samsung TV is, what might be its limitations, and where it particularly thrives. So, we will also look at the Samsung SmartThings app, however briefly, to show you what you can do with your TV on the app, and again, what some of the limitations might be for the time being. How accessible is the Samsung TV? Well, it does feature a screen reader called Voice Guide. It reads pretty much everything on the screen, as you would expect a screen reader to do. However, naturally, not everything is accessible on the Samsung TV as mentioned, especially when it comes to third-party apps. But the main TV functions are certainly accessible, and we will show you some of that. I've got the remote control here, standard TV remote control, lots of buttons. So we will find out how to recognize these buttons in a minute. But first of all, we will turn on the TV. Now, the power button is very recognizable for two reasons. And again, this is a big thumbs up to Samsung here. And other companies also like LG have done this before with their TV remotes. It has Braille on it next to certain buttons. So in this case, the power button has the Braille letter P to the left of it, and the volume button has the Braille letter V to the left of it, while the channel button has the Braille letter C next to it. So these buttons are easily locatable. So let's press the circular power button and see what we get. So the TV has now turned on. Now,
tab, two items, home, TV. This service is not available.
Now, the reason you have heard this is because due to copy.
BBC4 is on air daily from 7 p.m. Paragraph.
Now, the reason you've heard this announcement and the previous saying service is not available is because I have put on BBC4, and in the daytime, this channel is not playing any content, which for copyright reasons is probably best that we have silence. Now, we have focused on BBC4, as you may have heard the TV say. The screen reader voice is not the best quality and may not always be the clearest, but it's definitely there as a feature, which is excellent. Now, of course, if you have not got a voice guidance on this TV, when you get it out of the box, you may require sighted assistance when setting it up for the first time. However, if you're feeling brave and would like to try and turning on voice guide by yourself, there is a way to do it as long as you memorize a few bits and pieces. If you find the bottom row of buttons, put your finger on the button in the very far right bottom corner, then move your finger up to the button above it, and in the second row that is, and then move your finger to the left. Now, that button is the accessibility menu, and the switch to turn on voice guide is the first option. So all you will have to do is click the OK button, which is very clearly marked with two dots. Now, if you're able to do that, that's brilliant. If not, you might need to get a sighted assistant to help you, as at the moment, I'm not sure if there is a shortcut on the remote to turn on this feature. However, if you know what this shortcut is, do let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. We would love to make sure that, whether via our sources or your great listenership, we can get the information we need to the listeners. So if you know a shortcut to turn on voice guide on the Samsung TV, let us know. But the screen reader's on. All we need to know is what all these buttons are. So, I will go and take us into the accessibility menu and show you what you can find. As I've said, the button is in the second row from the bottom and is the second button from the right, if you are able to locate it that way. So we will press that.
Accessibility shortcuts, 14 items, voice guide, on.
So there you have it, there's the voice guide option. Unfortunately, I've not found a way to change its speech rate, so it seems we only have that option because this is a toggle. When you click on it, it will only turn it on and off. It won't bring you more options, but let's show you some of the other options.
Picture off, off. Audio description on, disabled. Subtitle off. Subtitle mode, normal, disabled. Subtitle language, preferred, disabled. Primary subtitle language, English. Secondary subtitle language, English. High contrast off. Enlarge off. Learn TV remote.
So this is the option that will help us. So I will press the OK button. As I've said, it has two dots on this remote, so it's fairly recognisable square button. I will press the OK/confirm button.
Press A button on the remote control to hear voice information on it. Press the return button twice consecutively to return to the previous screen. If you press the power button, the TV turns off. With the frame, art mode is activated when the power button is pressed.
So there we go. We are in the learn remote mode. We can now press any button and it will tell us what it is. I will press the button in the far right bottom corner.
Fast forward.
Then the button to the left of that.
Pause.
To the left.
Play.
Left again.
Rewind.
Then I will go to the second row from the bottom. Press the button at the first left.
Menu. Opens menu to change settings. Info. Shows further information on the current program while watching TV or in the program guide. Accessibility menu. Stop. Select to stop playback of recorded programs, current recordings and time shift.
I will go up and press a different button just to give a bit of variety.
Up arrow. Left arrow. Right arrow. Down arrow. Select. Guide. Rakuten TV. Netflix. Smart Hub. Prime Video.
So as you can tell, there are buttons that can give you direct access to some of the most popular streaming services. Now, I can be going like this forever because there's plenty of other buttons I've not pressed. But the main point is, this is how you can learn the layout of the remote to know which buttons to press. Because there is an alternative, You can possibly do this in the SmartThings app, but as you will find out later, that isn't as easy, and that there are third-party solutions that could be tried, but again, that depends on accessibility. So we will press the exit button, as I already know where it is.
Exit press to return to Live TV. Accessibility, 9 items, 6. Learn TV remote. TV. Smart Hub, 2 items, home.
Now, the main menu of the TV is also accessible, where you can actually connect your Wi-Fi to your TV and change a few other settings. So that is also read out by the voice guide screen reader, which would not take you through because you have seen how it works in the menu system. But what I want to show you is the TV guide, because it is a very accessible TV guide. So I will press the guide button on the remote.
Program guide, filter by all on now. DTV Terrestrial, 9, BBC 4, this is BBC 4, 5:30 to 18:58, daily from 7:00 p.m.
Okay, so I'm going to press, for example, the down arrow.
Classic Coronation Street, 10, ITV 3, 14:45 to 15:15, as the Nelsons party gets into full swing. Katie makes her feelings known to a shocked Martin, Steve tries to talk to Karen, and Curly continues to ignore Emma. S-Odd.
So there we go. It does tell you the description and the times, and you can also explore other programs going on by pressing the right arrow key to go further throughout the day.
Classic Coronation Street, 10, ITV 3. 15:15 to 15:50, Katie and Martin feel awkward following the previous evening. Curly is less than impressed when Emma tells him she has been promoted and Steve begs Karen to give him another chance. S-Odd. A Touch of Frost, 10, ITV 3, 15:50 to 18. Penny for the guy. A ruthless, calculating kidnapper holds a supermarket chain to ransom with the life of a young boy. Die Jack Frost knows he is facing his toughest deadline ever. SRS 5F1.
And you can also explore other channels by going up or down the TV guide respectively. And if you press the select button, it will allow you to set a reminder and display a reminder on the screen which will be read out to you 5 minutes before a program is due to start, or get more details about the program. So a very accessible TV guide, I think, which is very nice to see. So we will back out of that with the exit button.
Smart Hub, 2 items, home.
Now the good thing is it will also tell you which channel you are going to. So I'm going to type in 730, which regular listeners to RNIB Connect Radio, you may even be listening to it on your TV, may know what this channel number is. So let's type in 730.
Zero.
And breathed quickly.
730, RNIB Connect, talking books, 14 to 15:00.
The Jew catching the boy.
TV.
We're
this due. Is an audio channel and includes no video signals.
The Jew inflicted a smart blow on Oliver's show.
DTV Terrestrial, channel 9, BBC 4. This is BBC 4, 5:30 to 18:58. This service is not available.
So, as you have heard, I have put us onto the RNIB Connect radio channel. And as you may have heard, the TV read out the channel and what was currently on, and it has also told us that it is an audio channel only, therefore includes no visuals. So, that is how simple it is to change channels. Now, if you do have an Apple TV connected, or indeed an Amazon Fire Stick, or any other smart TV accessible interface connected to your TV, and you want to switch to it, you can do so in a very accessible way. My Apple TV is currently plugged into the HDMI port at the back of the TV, and I want to switch to HDMI. And you can do it by pressing the sources button on your remote, which, as mentioned, you can find out using the Learn TV remote function. So I'll press that button now.
Sources for items TV.
So we are focused on TV. I will now press the right arrow.
HDMI 1.
And we've got HDMI 1 here. Now I know this will connect me to my Apple TV if I press the select button. And from that point, I will be able to take the Apple TV remote and use my Apple TV. And if I fancy going back to TV, it will simply take the same function to get me there. but I will stick to TV.
TV. BBC 4 is on air daily from 7 p.m. Paragraph.
Now, that was a very brief demonstration of the Samsung's accessible TV and the voice guide screen reader. Hopefully you have found this useful, and hopefully that will encourage you to maybe look into getting a TV from Samsung, or in fact other companies such as LG, who do also have a similar function as well. What I will show you next is a quick tutorial of the Samsung SmartThings app, which can also be used with the Samsung TV. We will now go to the SmartThings app and show you what that looks like.
SmartThings. SmartThings, my home button.
So the app has now opened and we are in the main screen. Now, this SmartThings app from Samsung allows you to control your Samsung devices, in this case, the Samsung TV. So I'll show you what you can control using this app and what the limitations might be. Let's swipe around, let's swipe to the right and see what we find.
Add white button, possibly more white button, possibly more favorites heading. Samsung 32.9, this is BBC 4 button.
Now, as you can tell, this is reading out the Samsung TV, which I've got, and also reading out what on the screen of the TV, which is BBC 4.
Power button.
There's a power button which allows me to then turn the TV off should I want to.
Selected. Favorites. Tab 1 of 5.
Then we have the tab, so we've got favorites.
Devices. Tab 2 of 5. Life. Tab 3 of 5. Automations. Tab 4 of 5. Menu. Tab 5 of 5.
And a few other tabs alongside it, which we will not go through all of them, as I want to show you more of the focus on the TV. So we will swipe back to the left to find the TV.
Automations. Life. Tab. Devices. Tab. Selected. Favorites. Tab. One. Power. Button. Samsung 32.9. This is BBC 4. Button. Samsung 32.
So here we are. We are in the screen for the TV, so let's see what we've got.
More options. Button. Navigate up. Button. My home. Tech hub. Core first icon search. Button. Possible. Search the TV for content and apps.
So we can search the TV for content if we so wish.
Sources and apps. Select an app or connected device. Universal guide. Enjoy TV and film recommendations. Remote control. Button. Core control power. Button. Core control power. Button.
So these are the options you've got.
Remote control. Button.
I'll take you to sources and apps first.
Enjoy a TV and film. Universal guide. Select an app or connect it. Sources and apps. Samsung 32. More options. But navigate up. Button. My home. Tech hub. Source. TV. HDMI 1. Remote access. Apps. Remote control. Button. Apps. Remote access. HDMI 1. TV.
So as you've heard, this is the list of sources we have. So we have TV.
HDMI 1.
We have, well, what voiceover calls HDMI 1, but it is actually HDMI 1, which we had previously.
Remote access.
And something called remote access, which I have not tried. So, in other words, you can also switch sources using the Samsung app here on the TV. So I will double tap.
HDMI TV. HDMI 1.
So I will double tap on HDMI 1 and we will see what happens on the TV.
HDMI 1.
HDMI
1.
So you have heard my ridiculously fast screen reader on my Apple TV. I will now swipe to the left on the app.
TV.
And double tap on this.
TV.
DTV Terrestrial, Channel 9, BBC 4. This is BBC 4, 5:30 to 18:58. This service is not available. BBC 4 is on air daily from 7 p.m. Paragraph.
So as you can see, you can control the TV to a certain extent with the phone.
Source.
We will go back out of that.
Navigate. Navigate. Source. My home. Navigate up. Button. Sources and apps. Sources and apps. Select an app or connected device. Universal Guide.
You can also look at the Universal Guide and see what you can watch using the Samsung TV, and to a certain extent it should bring it up on the screen and hopefully play it, but I won't be able to fully show that, as obviously that would involve playing copyrighted material, which we cannot do. I will show you one more part in the app, which I wish was more accessible, because it would be a very nice feature.
Enjoy TV and film recommendations. Remote control. Button.
And it's this.
Button. Button.
So it's the remote control. Now, visually on the screen, we actually have the buttons on the remote control of the iPhone app. However, if we swipe through them...
Button. 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 Button.
As you can hear, we just hear button. 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 So unfortunately, that particular part of the app is not yet accessible, but hopefully we can reach out to Samsung and talk about it. Alternatively, you can also try at contacting Samsung to give accessibility feedback. So as you can see, that part at the moment is not accessible, which is a shame, but it would be good to have that, and hopefully this is something Samsung will be working on to improve, because that way you could control your TV with your phone even more so than you can already. So there we go, that was your brief demonstration on the Samsung Accessible TV with Voice Guide and the Samsung SmartThings app. What do you think? Has this made you want to get one? Do you have any questions? Do you have any other recommendations that we can try that I have not shown here? Do you have any other accessible TV companies that are equally as good? Tell us about it. We'd love to hear it. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Thank you very much for listening.
We return now to Dave's conversation with blind scientist Dr. Sherry Wells-Jensen.
I understand that life in the HAB involved various challenges, from, you know, managing ecosystems to conducting experiments. How did you adapt and contribute to the team during that time?
Well, we had a couple of things that everybody had to do. So everybody had to go back into that first room that I didn't like very much and go down a ladder and crawl through a tunnel into what we called the lung, which is one of the ways that the air pressure was managed. And we had to go crawl down there. It was actually intimidating at first because, again, it was kind of loud and echoey, which are two of my least favorite things. But we had to measure the height of this giant piece of equipment that was held up by air pressure, held up over our heads. And so that was something that everyone had to do. And they all did it by, actually, I don't know how they did it. They had a tape measure hanging down from it. And so one of the first things I did was whip out my slate and stylus and put braille markings on that tape measure. It was really interesting to me because there were a lot of super, super, super analog things that we did. So slate and stylus, pieces of paper, tape, bump dots, all over that place, lots of things like that. But then if I wanted to measure CO2 levels, I had to have electronic access. So I had an accessible LabQuest unit, which of those of y'all do chemistry will know what that little guy is. It's just it's a little unit, little handheld piece of equipment that you can connect various sensors to. So I had pH sensors, I had a CO2 sensor, I had a conductivity sensor, all kinds of things like that. And I connected them one by one to this little unit in my hand, which Independent Science has made so it talks. And so I could do the CO2 readings in different parts of the HAB. I could also use that same setup to measure the pH of the water both before we used it and then after we used it, to sort of get a handle on that. And so it was this amazing combination of your very basic blindness skills that you have known since you were, you know, 6 years old, like reading and writing Braille, putting a bump dot on, like there was a button that for the fire alarm to turn it off in case it went on, because as we all know, fire alarms are wicked loud and disorienting. So I wanted the one button I wanted on that thing labeled was, okay, if it goes off, I want to be able to run over there and turn that thing off so I can hear, so I can get out. So everything from bump dots and Braille labels put on with scotch tape to pretty sophisticated electronic access, like you have on your computer and like I needed to run those sensors. So it was interesting to me that it was not just super sophisticated, high-tech stuff. It was the basics that you do every day.
And tell me about the relationships with your crew. Had they met a blind person previously?
They had not. And, you know, you've always got that moment where you think, okay, team, how are we going to do this? And so we talked about things a little bit before we went in, but the training was pretty intense. And we didn't have a lot of contact before we went in. And so there was a lot of just observing each other and figuring out what each other needed. I did find that, I mean, the learning curve for this can be pretty steep. Luckily, these folks were pretty intuitive and nice. But we did find that sometimes there were moments when things, I think the one example I have that caused us to have another meeting was I was sitting right next to something that somebody needed who was in another room, and they hollered to somebody else in the lab, hey, go get the thing. And I was sitting right next to it, and I thought, why didn't you tell me to get off my backside and bring you the thing? And so there's this, if you're going to be in a crew together, you need to be all trusted. You can't have one person that's sort of being coddled. You need everyone to be there, tools in hand, feet on the ground, ready to do whatever it needs to be done. And so we had a few moments like that. I think we only had 6 days, so we were in the process of working through it. But I think we would have gotten there.
Tell me a little bit about reentry then. How did you feel afterwards?
It's funny. You know, the only thing I wanted, we got out and there was a bunch of reporters there and there was a big scene. And all I kept thinking was, I've been in a small place with the same people for 6 days. All I want to do is go get a burrito and eat it by myself in a quiet room. I don't want to know. I don't want to be with people. It's funny. You think that after isolation, you just want people, people, people. But what I wanted was no people. I just wanted to be all by myself.
Did you get your burrito?
I did get my burrito. I had to wait a couple of days because we were at a conference. We were released, and we had to be at a conference, which I thought was, well, that was rough. But yes, on my way home, I took an extra day. I got an Airbnb all by myself. I ordered food. I ordered a bunch of fresh fruit and my burrito, and I just got a science fiction novel and sat in those two rooms for 24 hours. And ate what I wanted to eat and spoke to no one. It was lovely.
Blind students wanting to pursue careers in science and related fields often encounter skepticism about, you know, how much they could contribute. What are some of the strategies and support systems that you think could help?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's a really important question. You're not responsible to do this all by yourself. None of us ever does anything all by yourself. Find a mentor who believes in you. If you have to ask around, be persistent, because that person who is already in the field who believes in you is invaluable. Cling to the people around you. So it's always, my disabled friends are my biggest resource, my allies from the sighted world also. But, you know, cling to your community. Don't think you have to do this alone. And genuinely do things that you love. I mean, if you are pursuing a goal your whole life and you're miserable the whole time, that's no kind of way to live, right? So think about not just where you want to be, You know, if you want to be an astronaut, very few of us are astronauts. It's a good goal. I recommend it. But along the way, you've got to be doing things that bring you joy. You've got to be doing things that every day you wake up and go, huh, I could, you know, there's like 9 things I have to do. I've got to do the dishes. I've got to, you know, there's a math problem. I got to do these things. But I also get to do this. And I like this. I love this. I love this. And so to make sure that the path that you're pursuing is a joyful path and that you're doing things along the way that bring you strength and joy and refresh your spirit. So the goal is not everything. It's about every day doing things that you want to do that really fill you up.
You talked about being a trusted part of the team, and I think sometimes that is the challenge for blind people seeking employment or feeling like we are fully active contributors in our jobs. Have you got any tips? Did you learn anything as a team about how you could be more integrated into the work that you carried out?
Oh my gosh, if I had the answer to that question, I would bottle it and and give it away to everybody. That I think is really the hard thing, right? Part of it for me comes from feeling like I'm capable of being trusted, which is an ongoing, I mean, we all drink the Kool-Aid of, you know, you're always going to be slower, you're never going to be quite as good, you need to be taken care of. And we hear those messages so much every day that they sink into us. And so for me, part of becoming trusted by other people is figuring out how much I believe those messages. How much do I really think that I'm always going to be slower and I'm never going to be as competent? And then sort of trying to wipe those out of my consciousness, like take care of them, like acknowledge that they're there and then figure out how can I weed that out? And then for me also, it's about doing little things. Like if somebody says, hey, I need a glass of water, am I the one that gets up? Do I push myself to be like, I know this is going to be awkward for everyone else, but if someone says they need something, how about if I get up? How about if I make myself get up and go get it, just so that A, I practice taking on responsibility, and B, they get to observe it happening. So a lot of it, and sometimes I think, well, why didn't, like, if I didn't want to go to the store and get something, do I go or do I wait for someone else to go for me or with me? And, you know, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, right? It's hard. But practicing those little pieces of initiative for me has been really important. And so that's the part that I can control, right? I can control, well, I can sort of control how I feel. I can work on the messages that are in my head. And I can work on the little things that I do every day. But then it becomes, then it gets tough, right? Because you can't control the outside world. So I rely a lot on my disabled friends, like, you know, to give me strength and guidance. And then sometimes it's useful just to talk it through. So when we had our daily meeting in the habitat, and one of the first days I said, you guys, here's what happened about the thing where, you know, I was sitting right next to it and you asked somebody else, and I'm not telling you that you're bad people, because, you know, I live in the same culture you do. And I also absorb those messages, but let's try together to think about that. And let's all work on this. And it genuinely took a lot of energy from me, to do those kinds of things, but I mean, it was worth it, right? It was an investment in my team. And I think we got better. So I don't know. I mean, it's an uphill battle. There's a lot to do and none of us are going to solve it alone. But being aware of the problem is the first step, I think.
In the realm of space exploration, accessibility and inclusivity are gaining more traction. I think the European Space Agency recently put out a call for disabled applicants. Where do you think we're headed with that? I mean, how far might that go?
I don't know. You know, so it's interesting that they did that. They were looking for folks with a single leg prosthetic, primarily, which, I mean, honestly, pretty easy. I don't see any, there's no barrier that I can really think of that's serious for a person with a single leg prosthesis to go to space. So I think they've picked, it's nice in that I'm pretty sure that program will be successful. Why wouldn't it be? But it seems like an awfully safe play. In thinking about the suborbital flights that we're having now, where people just sort of go up into space, they hang there for 3 minutes and they come back down, there's no reason at all why a blind or deaf person could not be on that tomorrow. I mean, it'd have to be kind of a rich blind or deaf person. I think it's several hundred thousand dollars a pop, right? But there's no barrier there. There's no practical barrier there. So I think it's going to come from probably the private space companies, because they've already flown people. One of the gentlemen that went up recently has Parkinson's, an older gentleman. They've flown someone with a titanium femur, the bone replacement. And I think it's going to come from them, because they're not as slow. A government agency is always just a little bit slower, just a little bit more careful. So I think slowly, if we keep pushing, inclusion will increase. Because in the end, a habitat in space is just a bunch of rooms put together. And we know how to make rooms accessible, right? We've all been in rooms. We know how to do this. We have our slates and styluses. Sometimes we have our computers with tech on them. We know how to do that. Things that are not accessible can be made accessible. So these are all 100% solvable problems. So I think if we let it alone, maybe nothing will happen. But if we keep pushing, if we keep on working on it, I am confident that we will integrate space.
And what message would you like to send to blind students who may be hesitant to pursue a career in STEM or other related fields?
I think the first thing I need to say is, look, I get it. I really get it. It feels like a lot. It feels like a lot, and you're going to be told over and over and over again, overtly and covertly, that you don't belong and it's not your place. And you're going to go into the lab and you're going to be the only disabled person there. And that's a load. It's a load to carry, and it's hard. It is hard. But I will also tell you this, that the satisfaction and joy that comes from doing what your heart tells you to do is powerful. And I don't know if those things equal out or not. And for some people they do, and for some people they don't, but you won't know it unless you try it. And if you find people that you can work with and you're doing things you love, it's the best way to live your life in the world. So again, I would say find a mentor, get with your friends so you have people to talk to, so you have a team that can help you troubleshoot, and do it. Just take a deep breath and do it. And it's scary. I get it. It's very scary. It can feel impossible. But if you assemble yourself a team, good people that you can talk to, a mentor, if you prepare yourself, you can be part of it. And you deserve to be part of it. Not a gift that somebody gives you. Science belongs to you as a human being. You own it. It is your birthright to do science, to explore the world around you. That belongs to you. That is not something that anyone should take away from you. So try, get out there, give it a shot, see if it's fun. And if it's fun, keep doing it. And if it's really hard, figure out a way to keep going. As long as it's fun, do it.
So what else are you working on just now, and how can we keep up to date?
Well, shoot, I guess I am going back to teaching. As a matter of fact, today I have to finish my fall syllabus and get it turned in. Don't tell my boss. But I am working. I'll get it done, I swear. And I do have a webpage at sherrywellsjensen.com. I'm going to be working on the same things. I'm just going to go back to Ohio for a year at least get back to teaching for a little bit. I'll be teaching linguistics and disability studies and whatever else they toss at me to teach, and doing the same work from there.
Well, Dr. Sherry Wells Jensen, thank you so much for talking with us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much.
That's it from Tech Talk this time, and space. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you've got any suggestions, feedback, comments, questions, or if you'd like to send us an email or voice note,
It's the usual address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Do tune in next time when I'll be speaking with our very own Technology for Life team, comparing and contrasting Daisy players. Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovich, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you next week.
From myself, Dave Williams, and the rest of the team, bye for now.